Welcome to Crisis Management. I'm Alicia Sikorska. On today's episode, the province of Ontario has joined the likes of BC, Manitoba, and Quebec and is introducing its own vaccine certification system. We'll take a look at Doug Ford's decision to do that, the challenges that may come with it, and what it means for the fight against COVID-19. And the Liberals have finally unveiled their campaign platform, so we'll take a look at the spending plans from all the major parties for the post-pandemic recovery. And we're also going to take a look at why the U.S. has upgraded its travel advisory for Canada. To get through all this, I am joined by Sean Speer. Sean is a fellow in residence at the Public Policy Forum. He previously served as senior economic advisor to Prime Minister Stephen Harper, and he's here to help us dig through the policy issues brought forward by COVID-19. Sean, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Alicia.
So let's kick things off with an update on the fight against COVID-19. For weeks now, Ontario Premier Doug Ford has resisted growing calls to implement a vaccine certification system for entry to non-essential services such as restaurants, gyms, and concerts. It's something we are seeing implemented in provinces like Quebec. And yesterday, the province finally unveiled its own system that will require people show proof of vaccination before entering certain indoor spaces. Here's what Ontario Premier Doug Ford had to say.
It's no secret. This is something that I did not want to do. This is a serious step that we're not taking lightly. And I know this is going to be very difficult for some people. And let me be clear. This is a temporary tool that we won't use for a day longer than we have to. But after talking to Dr. Moore, I know that this is what we have to do right now in the face of this fourth wave, because these certificates are necessary to keep our hospitals safe and to avoid another lockdown.
Now, the system will go into effect on September 22nd and will be required for indoor spaces, places like restaurants, bars, casinos, gyms, theaters, the list goes on. And to start, you'll need to just show your vaccination receipt along with a piece of government ID, and then the province plans on moving over to a QR code system by October 22nd. Now, Sean, before we get into how business groups have reacted to all this news, what did you make of the Ford government's announcement yesterday?
Well, Alicia, if viewers have watched previous episodes, we've talked about this subject a great deal, and I've always assumed that notwithstanding resistance on the part of the Ford government of Ontario and other provincial governments across the country, that we were going to get to this point. And I thought that for a couple of reasons. The first is, you know, it seems to me politicians want to avoid the risk of lockdowns after having committed to citizens that we're, you know, moving towards, the end of the pandemic, so to speak. And then second, of course, something we've talked about, the risk of growing social division between those who are vaccinated and those who are unvaccinated. And something like a vaccine passport enables those of us who are vaccinated to benefit from the kind of full range of economic and social activities, whereas those who've made the choice to be unvaccinated may face limitations in that regard. So all this to say, I'm not surprised. If anything, I'm surprised that it took the Ford government this long to come around on vaccine passports. But I think it's going to be something like this that's going to be necessary to push up our vaccination numbers. We've been stuck, at least relative to early days when we were making kind of exponential progress rather, with respect to vaccination rates. And so, you know, I think it's about time something like vaccine passports get put in place. And hopefully that will be enough to encourage non-vaccinated Ontarians to go and get the jab. And so they can similarly benefit from a full range of economic and social activities.
It will definitely be interesting to keep a close eye on the vaccination rates, especially for that first dose figure, because that's the one especially that has really tapered off in recent weeks in the province. Now, I do want to dig into what we're seeing from the business community and the reactions there. Many groups representing small businesses in Ontario are looking for additional details. They still have a lot of questions in terms of how this can be enforced, or, you know, if there's additional protections that are needed in terms of things like potential human rights challenges, all that kind of stuff. The Ontario Chamber of Commerce has also, they've been pushing for, one of the business groups that's been pushing for this system. And they actually said that Ontario could have gone a step further and provided a framework or additional guidance around workplace vaccination policies. Here's what Daniel Safayani from the Ontario Chamber said about this policy. "We are concerned that a lack of guidance is going to disproportionately burden small businesses with the task of creating, implementing, and enforcing their own employee vaccination policies that will ultimately lead to a patchwork of inconsistent policies across the province." This was also something we saw come up in the press conference with Doug Ford. You know, he was asked about the fact that you could be at a restaurant full of, you know, at a table with people that are fully vaccinated, but your server could potentially be unvaccinated. So Sean, do you think that the province should have gone a step further and done this workplace vaccination policies, or what do you make of this argument?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, on the question of the utility of vaccine passports with respect to customers or patrons, I mean, I think that the case is self-evident. In the absence of something like a vaccine passport, we were going to, in effect, deputize small business owners to be making judgments about who can enter their stores or their restaurants. And I think that was rife with risk with respect to accusations of discrimination and so on. So having the government step up and provide a framework for those decisions to, in effect, remove some of the burden on business owners makes good sense. Whether it ought to be extended to workplace arrangements and workplace policy, I'm not so sure. I mean, I think we're seeing, for instance, Alicia, a lot of companies respond to the pandemic in different ways. Some have really taken up and championed remote work arrangements, and indeed may continue that even in the aftermath of the pandemic. Others, for various reasons, whether because of the nature of their work or other circumstances, have chosen a hybrid model, and others, of course, have remained in the office or in the store or in the restaurant or whatever throughout the pandemic. So, you know, I think it seems to me that the employer-based approach to workplace policy, workplace arrangements has served us reasonably well. I'm not sure it's something that requires a kind of standardized policy across industry. So I would say good news with respect to how to handle customers or patrons or students or whomever else entering the premises of a business or institution. But I'm not sure I'm in agreement that the government should have gone further and extend a kind of one size fits all policy with respect to workplaces.
I do think it also gets a little complicated in terms of providing exemptions for people. That's not something that the government is doing with this policy here. And so I'm sure having two separate paths for workplaces versus the customers maybe would have been a complicated endeavor for the province to take on. But Sean, on that note about the divide in society between those that are vaccinated and those that are unvaccinated, now that the passport is, or, you know, so-called vaccine passport is coming to Ontario, is this, should the premier and policymakers, like, what should they be doing to ensure that this divide is not potentially made worse, or how do they begin to handle this?
It's a great question. And you know, we're seeing this divide play out on the campaign trail, of course, at the federal level, where Mr. Trudeau has been dogged by anti-vaccine protesters throughout the campaign. And he's used kind of increasingly blunt language, I think, to talk about the choices that the unvaccinated are making and the kind of broader impact that those choices have on the society. In effect, he's decided to, I think, confront the non-vaccinated. This is a subject of great debate, right? You know, do you ultimately persuade people with sticks, or do you persuade them with understanding and empathy? And I'm afraid I don't have a good answer, except to say the fact is, you know, we remain kind of increasingly stuck in terms of progress with respect to vaccinations. And that's worrying. You know, we saw from the Ontario Science Table this week that it's their collective view that we need to get something approaching 85% vaccinated in order to better protect the province. And we remain far from that goal. And so hopefully the vaccine passports bring some clarity to the choice that the non-vaccinated are making, and that will serve to kind of tip some of those into getting vaccinated. But I do think that it's going to require, on the part of business leaders, politicians, and others, a kind of a bit of carefulness in terms of kind of navigating these questions, so that we're encouraging the non-vaccinated to get vaccinated without creating a deep social divide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's such a complicated issue, and you're right, it's definitely emerged on the campaign trail. Definitely something to keep an eye on. But I do want to shift over to some economic data that we've actually received this week that actually caught some economists by surprise. Canada's economy, as measured by real GDP, contracted in the second quarter of the year, declining by 1.1% at an annualized rate. Now, this drop is the first quarterly decline that we've seen since the pandemic began, and it's far off from what economists were expecting. They had predicted GDP to actually increase 2.5%, and it fell 1.1%. So in terms of why we're seeing this decline, Statistics Canada said that exports have fallen due to things such as the supply chain constraints that we're seeing around the world. A slowdown in housing activity also dragged this number down. But the data appears to be showing that perhaps the recovery is not as strong as people were expecting. And so in light of that, Sean, how do you think policymakers should be looking at this latest data?
It's a great question. As you say, a big surprise. Some of it can be attributed to factors like supply chain disruption that you mentioned. One of the things, though, that struck me from the data is the extent to which consumer spending is growing slower than was projected. In effect, people are keeping their money on the sidelines, and that was reflected in another strong set of months and quarter with respect to household savings. So, you know, what's really interesting, and this is something we've talked about on this program for several months now, is that on one hand, there are the public health restrictions. On the other hand, there are the kind of restrictions that people are placing on themselves in terms of their participation in the economy and society. And I think what these data tell me is, irrespective of whether governments impose or withdraw different public health restrictions, people are cautious, people are uncertain, and that's being reflected in some apprehensions in terms of getting out and acting like consumers as they had prior to the pandemic.
So do you think policymakers should be looking at measures to encourage people to deplete their savings and spend that in the economy, whether it's through something like what the Conservatives have been proposing, the GST holiday in December? Is that something that they should be taking a closer look at?
So I would say I think there's two things. The first is setting out a kind of framework with respect to vaccines that people can understand and that can give them confidence that when they go into a restaurant or a store, that the risk of transmission is low. And that's where I think vaccine passports are a key part of the answer. And then secondly, as you say, Alicia, there may be a case that we need incremental action, that it's not just enough to satisfy people's concerns around risk, that to get them off the sidelines and back into the economy, they're going to require an inducement. And, you know, that may make the case for something like the Conservatives have promised in this campaign, which is a GST holiday in the month of December. But I would go so far as to say, Alicia, that if we don't solve the first problem, the benefits of something like a GST holiday are going to be necessarily minimized or undermined. So I think it's crucial that we roll out vaccine passports, that we make further progress on vaccines. If we can do that, I think a lot of this consumer and investor activity will be restored, irrespective of whether we still go ahead with either the Conservative plan for a GST holiday or the current government's plan to spend $100 billion over the next 3 years in the name of stimulating the economy. Seems to me those are kind of second order questions. We need to give people confidence about safety as the first order challenge to policymakers.
Now, before we dig into those spending plans from the Liberals, Conservatives, and the NDP, I do want to talk about one other policy proposal that the Conservatives have included. Erin O'Toole has promised to overhaul unemployment benefits so that payments would automatically increase when economic data is showing that the recession is underway. This is known as the Claudia Sam rule. It's named after a former Federal Reserve economist. The idea is essentially that the benefits would increase and decrease based on the needs that we're seeing in the economy, and it wouldn't require parliamentarians to go vote in the House every time they need a boost in the event of a recession. As Bloomberg reports, if the Conservatives are elected, it would be the first major economy to test out this kind of economic policy. So, John, do you think that we should be seeing more programs directly tied to these kind of economic indicators, you know, such as unemployment rates, even potentially GDP? Is that something that parties should be taking a closer look at?
Yeah, if you could just bear with me, I'll try to be as minimally wonky as I can. You know, the basic idea here is that we build hardwire into legislation what are sometimes referred to as automatic stabilizers. So the idea is if there's a recession or an economic shock of some sort, rather than governments having to scramble to introduce legislation and pass legislation to establish emergency measures, they would be legislated in advance so that if a recession happens or a pandemic or some other kind of economic shock, those emergency provisions are already in place and can be rolled out more quickly. And I think, you know, given the experience of the pandemic, I think there's a strong argument for this kind of idea. It would have saved us days, weeks, even months to get out emergency support to individuals and households. Just a couple of caveats. The first is not every recession is the same. You know, this one, for instance, disproportionately affected, at least initially, women in the service-based sector, whereas the 2008-2009 recession disproportionately affected men in the goods-producing economy. So there are some kind of limits on how much you can hardwire into legislation and prejudge the outcomes of any given recession. So in other words, there's going to have to be a mix of automatic policies like this one and still room to have more responsive policies that reflect the particular circumstances of recession. The second point I would just make quickly, Alicia, is the other change that needs to be considered with respect to employment insurance is not just making more generous benefits automatic in the event of a crisis. The fact remains that a significant share of Canada's working population isn't eligible for employment insurance, either because they haven't worked for the same employer for a sufficient time to be eligible, or they may be gig workers with kind of multiple jobs that cumulatively don't qualify for EI benefits. The reason that we had to move ahead with the CERB in the context of the current recession or the past recession was because leaving it to EI would have meant that a significant share of workers in our economy would have been covered. So all this to say, I think it's a really interesting proposal. I do agree that we ought to be pursuing it, just with a couple of caveats that it's not a silver bullet. We're still going to need a broader set of changes and some kind of recession-specific policies to ensure that no Canadian is left behind in the event of the next economic shock, whatever it is that brings it about.
Well, as I mentioned, this is just one of the many proposals that the Conservatives have as part of their platforms. This week, the Liberal Party unveiled its campaign platform, meaning we now have all of the party's election plans and proposals that we can compare. The Liberal platform includes $78 billion in new spending over the next 5 years to help get Canada through the post-pandemic recovery. The money we've heard is going to be put towards policies that have been previously announced, things like $10 a day childcare, new mental health transfers to provinces, as well as an extension of the Canada Recovery Hiring Program. And now the Conservatives have also promised to restore 1 million jobs in the pandemic through its Canada Job Surge Plan, which would subsidize salaries for new employees, kind of similar to the wage subsidy after that program expires. They've also promised to increase the growth of the Canada Health transfers to provinces. The NDP, which released its platform before the election, it includes plans to introduce national childcare, pharmacare, dental care programs, full paid sick leave for workers, as well as a wealth tax on the so-called super rich. But Sean, it seems like no matter where you look, the plan is to kind of spend the way out of the pandemic and through the post-pandemic recovery. What do you make of these plans to help get Canada on the other side of COVID-19.
Yeah, I think your characterization is right. We spoke last week about, you know, the extent to which Canadian federal politics has gone through this pretty extraordinary sea change over the past decade or so. We went from a broad-based political consensus in favor of balanced budgets to today in 2021, when virtually all of the parties are promising at least medium-term deficits and a pretty significant accumulation of debt over the next 5 years. You mentioned the Liberal platform would add $78 billion in incremental spending over the next 5 years. It would also add about $70 billion to the projected deficits over that period of time. So in other words, the deficits that were outlined in the 2021 budget last April, this past April, would be cumulatively $7 billion higher. We don't have the data, the fiscal projections for the Conservatives and the Democrats at this stage. But I think it's fair to say that they wouldn't differ markedly in that regard. I would just make a couple of quick points. You know, the first is, like any election campaign, there's some really interesting ideas across the platforms and then some really bad ideas across the platforms. The one that's kind of interesting that viewers might have missed, but that, you know, they ought to know about because it's been committed to by both the Liberals and the Conservatives, which means there's a reasonable probability it gets effectuated irrespective of who wins the election, is the creation of something they're calling the Canada Advanced Research Projects Agency, which would be modeled on a similar agency in the United States called DARPA, which basically exists to fund high risk, high reward scientific and technological inventions. DARPA is credited, for instance, with seeding the technological basis of what is now our GPS system. And DARPA had a pretty significant role to play in the creation of the mRNA vaccines, which, of course, everyone is now familiar with. So this is a kind of interesting idea to, in effect, Alicia, create at the federal level a capacity to prioritize not just general innovation, but what you might describe as breakthroughs or what's sometimes referred to as wild cards. So I think that's an interesting idea and one that we'll no doubt hear more about, given that both of the major parties have committed to it and ostensibly will one of them will effectuate after the election campaign.
It's interesting that you raise that policy up because it does speak to an issue that we've discussed a lot on the show before, and that's training, you know, the workforce and getting the economy ready for, you know, more technological innovations and kind of investing in that side of the economy. It's not something we've heard a lot about on the campaign trail. Is that something that you think should be the focus going forward, addressing, you know, the changing labor market and the direction that our economy is going, which is going to be a fundamental shift from where we are now?
Yeah, the short answer is yes, of course. An election campaign, I'm afraid, tends to be focused on, you know, what the different parties are offering individual Canadians and their households in terms of benefits and tax credits and all the rest. But fundamentally, our future living standards are rooted in innovation and productivity. And our ability to pay for all of this spending that the various parties are promising, of course, is higher rates of economic growth. So you're right that these types of proposals aren't getting a lot of attention in the campaign, but they're pretty fundamental to Canada's economic future. And so I'm pleased that both of the major parties have committed to create this this idea of a DARPA-like agency in Canada. You know, I look forward to the silly season elections being over and kind of drilling into how to design, operate and provide kind of governance around an organization like this so that it actually can contribute to breakthrough inventions in Canada and ultimately innovations that can be commercialized and exported by Canadian-based firms.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that develops. And yeah, as we mentioned, this is going to be key for financing all of these spending plans. The Trudeau Liberal plan says it will be fully financed by the tax revenue windfall from an expanding economy. So definitely need that economy to actually expand and the workforce and innovation to continue. But Sean, before we wrap up the show, I want to talk about, once again, the Canada-US border. Last month, Canada reopened its border to our U.S. neighbors, allowing fully vaccinated Americans to come to Canada without having to quarantine. But this week, the U.S. State Department escalated its travel advisory for Canada from level 2 to a level 3, urging Americans to reconsider traveling to Canada. Now, the Centers for Disease Control in the U.S. said that this upgrade is mainly for the benefit of those that are not vaccinated against COVID-19, but it has also sparked some strong reactions from the tourism industry in Canada, which, of course, has just been battered by the COVID-19 pandemic and subsequent border closures, especially ahead of a key long weekend. Sean, what do you make of this travel advisory and the fact that the U.S. is advising Americans not to travel to Canada?
I think it's absolutely bonkers. Let's put this in some context. For weeks and months leading up to the Canadian government's decision to open the U.S. border, we were facing calls from U.S. policymakers, including members of Congress and even the administration, to do so. And at that time, we were perceived to be the obstacle to the reopening of the Canada-U.S. border. We've now, it's been, several weeks since Prime Minister Trudeau and other spokespersons for the government made this announcement, and yet we remain impaired by U.S. policy. And in fact, this week, as you say, a further announcement on the part of U.S. Officials about coming to Canada. I don't understand it, Alicia. You know, if I could just make one comment that I think is part of this overall story. I think it reflects weak representation on the part of the U.S. government in Canada. In the past, the U.S. ambassador to Canada would have been a pretty high profile position. I mean, can a viewer name the U.S. ambassador to Canada right now? The answer is no. And on the same token, we've had some pretty high profile ambassadors of our own in Washington over the years, but multi-partisan, by the way. Gary Dewar, the former NDP premier from Manitoba, Michael Wilson, the former finance minister under Brian Mulroney, and then most recently, David McNaughton, who, of course, had a close relationship with members of the Trudeau government. Our current ambassador is capable and able, but she doesn't quite have the profile of some of these past ambassadors. One can't help but think that a failure on the part of the Canadian government to appoint someone with a bit more sway and influence and kind of profile in Washington. And on the same token, the administration's disappointing selection of an ambassador to Canada is sort of contributing to this kind of ongoing bilateral issue, which is harming the economies of both countries and really just seems to fly in the face of what we know about our country's respective performance on COVID-19. So I called it absolutely bonkers at the beginning, and I think that's right, but it does sort of beg some bigger questions about the way we're engaging the U.S. and the U.S. is engaging us, and whether there ought to be changes after the next election when it comes to Canada's representation in Washington.
Should we be reading into this decision and what it means, what it potentially means for the state of the Canada-U.S. relationship, given it's been months and months and the border is still effectively closed after such a long period of time?
I think the answer is yes, especially since, Alicia, I mean, it's important for viewers to understand, there have been high-profile American legislators making the case for reopening the border. Chuck Schumer, the Democratic majority leader in the Senate, for instance, has been a voice in favor. So the fact that the administration continues to hold this position, I think, does speak to a kind of fundamental structural problem that hopefully higher profile, more effective representation on both sides of the borders could help to solve. But you're right, I think, that Canadians and Canadian policymakers ought to be worried about what this says about the state of our broader relationship.
Okay, Sean, I'm afraid we've run out of time, so we'll have to leave the conversation there. Thank you so much, as always, for an interesting conversation.
Thanks, as always, for having me.
Now, if you want to rewatch this episode or get the latest news about the coronavirus pandemic, please visit the Yahoo Finance Canada website. For more bonus content, please make sure you check out our podcast on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. And if you have any questions for Sean or feedback about the show, please feel free to email me. I'm at Alicia at yahoofinance.com. Thanks for watching.